Community Radio.
It's about real people.
Not sound bites.
Not more talking heads.
Not on this show.
Interchange is a community access media forum fostering unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Conversations that challenge the ways we perceive the world around us.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to tonight's edition of Interchange. I'm Helen Harrell, and my guest tonight, I'm very delighted to speak with Susan Renee, who is the Executive Director of Options for Better Living. Welcome to Interchange, Susan.
Oh, thanks for asking me to come.
Well, it's great. I think you're one of those people in one of those positions that does a lot of hard work and gives a lot to the community, but I don't think everybody necessarily ever hears about Options, or maybe if they do, they aren't sure what you do. So, but first, before we talk about the organization and all that it does, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, I'm a local person. Actually, I'm from Bedford and just came here actually in 1985. I had been working in Martinsville. Didn't go too far from Bedford, but had been working in Martinsville and was fortunate to get a job at Stonebelt here in 1985. So I came back to Bloomington, which is where I got my bachelor's degree, and went back to school and got a master's, and worked at Stonebelt for a period of time, and then went to work for the university for about 8 years. There I did training and technical support all across the state in services to people with disabilities. And then in 1998, the position at Options came available, and I knew Options. I knew them from my work with Stonebelt and was very, very impressed with the organization and what they did. So I was fortunate that I was chosen to be their executive director. And 12 years later, I'm still here.
You're still here doing great work. What about you, or what about the profession? And it's certainly not necessarily an easy field, I think, to work in, working with disabilities and learning disabilities and physical disabilities. Mm-hmm. What about it drew you into this career?
I think I got here the same way a lot of people get into services for people with disabilities. I actually knew someone who worked in the field who started talking to me about the job and talking to me about an opportunity that she knew about. And I had a bachelor's degree in psychology, which with a BA in psychology, you know what you can do.
Right, you can teach or...
Right, you can go back to school or you can go back to school.
Right. So
I thought maybe this might be a place I could use the things that I had learned up to that point in time. So I just went in and started working with individuals and actually fell in love with it. There's something about being able to make a difference in someone's life, mm-hmm. seeing someone grow, seeing somebody doing things that, we oftentimes think are ordinary, and being totally amazed by them. I've had the opportunity to see people move into their first home ever from an institution. I've had the opportunity to see people get their first job ever, people who have been unemployed for, 40 years. I've had an opportunity to see people move out of institutions that have lived there for 50 years and kind of been forgotten in those institutions. And so you can't do that and not be a bit changed by the experience and by the strength that the people bring to that and teach you. I often say I've learned a lot more from the people that I work with than I've ever taught them.
What types of things did you do at Stonebelt?
There I was the director of adult services, and we at the time were implementing a brand new program back in 1985 we called Supported Employment. And back then, the idea of people with more significant disabilities working in the community was just unheard of. If you had a fairly significant disability, what people thought was, we'll find a place for you and keep you safe. And the thought of people in community jobs was just unheard of. So we learned about some demonstration projects and decided we would try that. We would try helping people to learn how to work in community settings instead of working in a workshop. And that was really amazing and a wonderful learning experience for me and for the individuals I think that we work for, because we're able to grow that program. And now I think that's kind of the standard for people with disabilities, is that we expect them to be able to go to work and keep a job.
Well, when I was doing a little bit of research about options, I noticed that it started under the name of Better Living for Special People. What was it? What was the organization like back then? What were the goals back then, maybe as compared to now?
Yeah, it was started by a group of families back in 1982. And in 82, there weren't really a lot of resources available for people to be at home in their community. There were three group homes. There was nothing for families who had a child who lived with them. And so Better Living for Special People was designed initially to allow families to keep their son or daughter at home in their community. So it started really small. It started with 20 families in that first year, and provided a service called respite. And that's a service where a trained person comes in and provides support to the son or daughter who has a disability, so that the family can go about, you know, sometimes just day-to-day life and get those things accomplished that they might not be able to otherwise.
I was going to say, I have a stepson who was born with multiple birth defects, and I know that it's very hard. I don't think anyone, unless they've actually experienced it, knows what it's like to try and even have a moment to yourself go somewhere. It was, you know, hard to find a babysitter, anybody to come in. And I actually remember the respite, some of the respite people from back then. Were most of the people, were these programs focused on learning disabilities or physical disabilities or both?
I think both. Originally, most of the money that was available, or pretty much all of the money that was available, were for individuals with intellectual disabilities or developmental disabilities, mm-hmm. so mental retardation, cerebral palsy, epilepsy, autism. Since that time, there's been some dollars that have come into play that have allowed options to expand to people who have physical disabilities, people who have traumatic brain injury. And most recently, we've been able to help families who have, a senior at home that they're caring for. Mm-hmm. Yeah, 'cause we know that, you know, actually that caregiving is increasing. You know, we know that the number of people who are taking care of an elderly mom or dad is just increasing exponentially.
Is Options a not-for-profit?
We are. We are a 501c3. And
how are you doing with funding currently?
Oh my, really good question.
Is this one of those programs that's going to be cut, or is
it? Well, most of our money comes from Medicaid. Medicaid is a state and federal match. So whenever there's a downturn in the economy, Medicaid gets to be one of the first targets for cuts. Our total budget was $8 million. We've lost $1.2 million of that over the last 2 years as a result of cuts. So that's a pretty substantial portion of our budget. So we've had to make big changes. Certainly that means that we've had to cut back on staff. We've tried as much as possible to maintain the services that we provide to people. So, it's been a difficult couple years, I think.
Well, I was going to say there's got to be overhead. And then how many staff do you have?
We have 275, and we cover now a 7-county area. So we started, in 1982 with 20 families in Monroe County, and we now serve 7 counties in South Central Indiana. And we've grown, actually, as the needs have grown, because, again, individuals and families want to stay at home, as close to home as possible. Mm-hmm. So we've tried to expand our services to make sure that's available for people. But again, the last couple of years have been pretty challenging, and there are, I think, statewide around 22,000 people waiting for services. because it's pretty much stopped the inflow of people into those services.
Well, you know, when on the surface of things, it sounds like you have a huge staff, but what's the ratio kind of from staff to clientele?
That's a good question, because we serve around 300, 325 individuals. So the ratio is pretty oftentimes 1-to-1, because that's, you know, 1-to-1 person to one individual is how we support people in their homes. And just to be clear, we provide kind of a myriad of services that are in-home that help that person stay at home, employment support, behavior support, and healthcare coordination and group living. So some of those services are 1-to-1.
How are people, how are they referred to you? Well, quickly about staff. Are all those staff paid? Are they volunteers?
No, those are all paid staff.
They're all paid staff.
They're all paid
staff. Do you have volunteers that work with the program?
We do. We have volunteers that help with, we have a program we call Continuing Education, in which we have daily living skills classes at various places around town. And we have volunteers that help with that. We have volunteers that come in and help with our special events and with our office. And then we have volunteers that help to organize events for the people we serve.
For people who are listening who might know of someone who might need help, or maybe they themselves would like some help or would fit in with the definition of your services, can you give us a little bit of an outline of how people are referred to you and what process you go through? There must be an intake process and an evaluation. And
There is. Typically, when someone comes to us, we find out as much information about them as we can and find out where they've already been in the system, because the system, I can tell you, is just, if you know anything about the system, you know how complicated it is.
I do, but some people might not. And
my.
Might help with fundraising if they did know how complicated it is. It's
well, nightmare. It depends on the individual and their disability, actually, where they go to get and intake for eligibility purposes. So if someone has a physical disability or a traumatic brain injury, or is just has a disability and they're not sure what kind of services they might have access to, they go to the Area Agency on Aging first. And that organization can assist in determining eligibility.
Even if they're young, they would
even
go
if
there?
They're young.
Oh, okay.
Even if they're young. Yeah, I know. It makes no sense whatsoever. But the area agencies are kind of charged with case management around some of the disability, what are called disability waivers or disability money for long-term support. And then if somebody has a need in employment, they go to vocational rehabilitation. Mm-hmm. And that entity, it's a state agency, and they determine eligibility. If somebody has an intellectual disability or a developmental disability, they go to the Bureau on Developmental Disabilities.
Is this written out somewhere?
No.
It's not.
Of course not.
So where would they start? Like doctor referrals, teacher referrals?
Oftentimes healthcare? We get self-referrals, mm-hmm. or we get referrals from families or schools. And then again, what we can do is kind of help them through where it is they need to go, because it is so complicated. Mm-hmm. So I always encourage people to give us a call. We have an 800 number, 800-875-9615. And then we have a person who's in charge of our referral and outreach. Her name is Dani Norris. And she can kind of help people understand the system and help them think about where's the best place to start. Because sometimes if you want a job, the best place to start is VR, regardless of your disability. Mm-hmm. But if you want in-home services and supports, there may be a couple different directions you can go. Yeah.
So it sounds like not all you. It's kind of like you're kind of a clearinghouse in a way.
We like to, because we know how hard it is. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, generally what happens is that we get a referral from one of those state agencies. And at that point in time, we can develop a plan with the individual. And we will sit down with them and their family and anybody else that's involved in supporting them to kind of decide what it is they want us to help them with and how they want us to do that. And so for each person, we develop what we call an individual support plan. And that kind of helps outline what it is we do and how we do it.
So you get a call, you get a phone call, or someone in your office gets a phone call from some parent who is just totally in a panic. They have a child who their behavior is maybe sort of out of control, whether it's at school, maybe they aren't even in school, maybe they're at home. Do you have them come in? Do you send someone out to them? I mean, how do you...
Well, probably, I should say, either one of those, whatever seems to work best for that person. I mean, we oftentimes will go to them just, again, because we want to see where that person is and what kind of supports they're going to need long term. So we probably would go visit them. Again, if they're comfortable coming into the office and talking to us, we'll do that as well. And then we'll try to connect them as quickly as we can with people who can help. In emergency situations, there are some funds that can be available that the state can make available on emergency situations. Say the family member has passed away and there's nobody to support that individual. Mm-hmm. In those cases, there may be some emergency funds that we can help them get access to.
How directly do you work with, like, Stone Belt?
Oh, very closely, actually. And a lot of times
are there referrals back and forth?
Yes, actually.
And what kind of referrals? I mean, what kinds of things does Stone Belt handle, and what kinds of things do you?
Well, we do a lot of the same kinds of things, but some of the things that they do, including they have a sheltered workshop where people work in their buildings, and we don't do that. So if somebody needs that, we can send them, make that referral over there. Oftentimes, we're working with the same people. Mm-hmm. They're working in their workshop, and we're supporting them at home. So we work very closely together, because you have to ensure things work well for the person.
Well, they have residential?
They do. I mean, they have group homes, and they also have supported living services. So in some ways, we overlap in that area, because we also do supported living and group home services.
Okay, well, we have to take a station break here. You've been listening to I'm Helen Harrell talking with Susan Rennie, who is the Executive Director of Options for Better Living. We will be right back. Welcome back to Interchange. I'm Helen Harrell, and my guest tonight is Susan Rennie, who's the Executive Director of Options for Better Living here in Bloomington. We've been talking a little bit about, well, the organization and all the varying things you do. One question that kind of pops up in my mind is, the population you mostly serve, would you say they are learning disabled or physically challenged?
Most of the people we serve have an intellectual disability. So they have what has been called mental retardation in the past, kind of mm-hmm. the new term that there's a law called Rose's Law, as a matter of fact, that was just passed federally that requires everybody to switch over to the terminology intellectual disability. But that's probably 70% of the people that we support. And so that means that they have a learning disability that's significant enough that they fall under the 70 IQ.
Mm-hmm.
So anybody under 70 IQ would be eligible for funding under that developmental disabilities. It also includes people with cerebral palsy. And again, what the state does in determining eligibility is they look at the severity of the disability. So if someone's disability is more mild, they might not be eligible, even if mm-hmm. they have autism, cerebral palsy, or an intellectual disability.
Well, I know I'm thinking that, you know, sometimes when people are, do you do testing? Intellectual testing?
We don't. Generally, that testing is done as a result of the eligibility process the state does.
And so that would be, they would be referred to you after that, or do you refer people for testing?
No, they would be referred with that. They would already have that testing when they come to us.
Because I'm thinking sometimes there's a fine line of intellectual ability. Like if someone has a handicap and they are perceived by our culture as being handicapped from being a child, that their learning processes, they might not have been expected to learn as well.
Yeah.
In other words, people see something and they project, well, this person, they're disabled, so therefore they aren't smart either. And they don't go hand in hand necessarily. I know quite a few people that are physically disabled and I have to, a little aside here that's not about you or options at all, is that when I was in high school, my mother volunteered for me to work a summer at a cerebral palsy camp. Uh-huh. And at first I was extremely upset with her. I cannot imagine. As a 16-year-old, that's how I wanted to spend my summer. But it was probably the most amazing learning experience I ever had, was working with these and realizing that, no, just because they have a physical disability doesn't mean there isn't a great person.
Exactly.
And that they don't have intellect. And of course, we know there's all ranges of severity, but that there are certainly many, many things that people can do that have varying degrees of disability. So I was just wondering how you define the disabilities, how Indiana defines the disabilities, and what levels there are of help, or if there are a cutoff where people don't qualify?
There are, for certain types of funding, certainly for developmental disability funding, there's a cutoff, and it's pretty much if your IQ is above 70-75, you're not going to be eligible. But, you know, I'd like to go back to something that you said, which is so true. Oftentimes people expect if somebody has an obvious physical disability that person also has an intellectual disability. Mm-hmm. And that's so not true. And unfortunately, in the past, what's happened is a result of that thinking and that kind of way that people have approached individuals is they might not have gotten the resources and the training that they should have gotten all along because those expectations were so low. There's a gentleman that lived in this infamous institution in New York, and he lived there all his life from the time he was 2 years old. And when they finally closed the institution, he came out and got the training, and as a result of that and people changing their minds about him, he actually went through, became a paralegal, and is helping other people that are in that situation get out of that situation.
I don't know which that says more about him or the law profession. You know, you can think about that. But At any rate, I'm thinking there are also plenty of people who may come in under that 70 IQ rating that actually can function quite well, too. Something, when you mentioned eliminating the term retarded, I know back in the 50s, if anybody was a slow learner in any way, they were kind of expected that they couldn't do anything. And we've certainly found that not to be true.
Oh, right. Now, and that's exactly what we've what we try to help people to understand is that the individuals that we work with can do anything. They can hold jobs. They can be part of their communities, their consumers, their neighbors, their parishioners, their friends. And that's been a great change. It's kind of been a sea change over the last 20, 25 years in the way we think about people with even the most significant learning disabilities.
The flip side of that kind of is, how do you find the community? I suppose Bloomington, since it's a pretty fair-minded community anyway, probably open to a lot of placement, job placement for people who might you know, have some disabilities or whatever. But are there a lot of businesses here that are open to hiring people with special needs?
There are. Actually, this is a great community. In fact, there's a group called Diversity Works, which is a group of employers who employ people with disabilities, who promote the employment of people with disabilities to other employers. So it's them talking to other employers and talking about the benefits of hiring individuals, so that it kind of breaks down the myths that sometimes people have, that, you know, people might, you know, be more accident prone. Well, nope. It might be more costly to hire somebody with a disability. Well, nope. In fact, it's, you know, if you look at the average cost of an accommodation, it's less than $150, which I would challenge most employers probably do that for all of their employees mm-hmm. and making accommodations. So in this community, there are lots and lots of employers, the Bloomington Hospital, the City of Bloomington, Cook Incorporated.
The grocery stores.
Yes. And their Best Buy, you know, even big chains that are really promoting the hiring of individuals. And, you know, I think even in the smaller communities that we work in, sometimes we think that the attitudes are different in the smaller communities, but really not. When you really go in and talk to people, because the individuals we represent are people that they know, you know. The families live in that community. They have connections, you know, in terms of, you know, their friends and families who know them. So I think communities in general support individuals, not because they have disabilities, but because they know them as people. And that's, you know, what gets support in place for individuals is getting past the disability. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think we talk too much about that and really need to play on the connections. And that works really well, in regardless of what community that you live in. I once worked with individuals in a really small town in Indiana. And it, you know, one of those towns that if you blink, you're through it. And I worked with a group of community members there and talked to them about the individuals that we were trying to find jobs for, because the jobs were hard to find in that community. It was kind of hard to find the community, honestly. And they came together and we talked about what the people's skills are and that kind of thing. And they were the ones, the community members were the ones that came up with job ideas, not us professionals, because mm-hmm. they knew the community better than we did. And they knew things that were like the detailer that worked out of his garage, you know, that we sure. would never know.
So. Right. Does Options do anything about accommodation? Like if you actually find a position or approach a business, for instance, and you have someone that would perhaps fit in that environment to work there, but they may need some special accommodation. Do you find businesses resistant to you know, setting up, arranging that accommodation, or?
No, unfortunately, there
are. Do you ever have to do any advocating?
We do have to do some advocating from time to time. And we have this thing called the ADA, the Americans with Disabilities Act, and that's kind of something that we try not to pull out of our pocket too often, but sometimes we do have to remind employers that those accommodations are things that they need to do. And what we try to do is figure out how we can help the employer get that put in place, and even try to look at what kind of funding there might be for that. Because there is, under the ADA, a tax credit for the employer if they have to renovate their bathroom or put mm-hmm. a ramp in, or, you know, just make it, you know, make some kind of physical change to the building. There's a tax credit through the ADA. And then vocational rehabilitation will often fund accommodations that person can use on the job. Now, they have to take them back with them if they ever leave that job, but it keeps the employer from having to make that investment sometimes.
Sure. I know that IU, for instance, when they do any remodeling now of any older buildings, they have to make sure it's ADA compliant.
Yes.
And I think in some ways it's probably slowed down renovation of some of these buildings, because it can be costly when you look at some of these older buildings, but it's certainly necessary, because everyone should be able to have access. How is Bloomington measuring up as far as making things accessible, like streets and street corners and buildings and Well, is this a case by case?
It is. It is. But I think for the most part, pretty good. There was a few years ago, we had a little bit of a battle around the sidewalks downtown. I don't know if you recall that, but there was an ordinance that was being proposed to make sure that there was a clear path, a 60-inch clear path on the sidewalks. And it was at the time when sidewalk cafes were just coming into vogue.
Right.
So people were really upset about maybe losing a bit of their space. So that was a bit of a challenge. It was fun because we had the opportunity. I work on a group called the Council for Community Accessibility. It's part of the city. And we had an opportunity to talk to the city council about that ordinance and how important it was, and to talk to the building owners so that they understood why it was so important. And we made a little accommodation. We went from 60 inches to 48 inches. Mm-hmm. So, but we did get a 48-inch clear path all the way around the square. And I think the other thing that we did at the same time was open people's eyes up to the fact that they were probably not as accessible as they thought they were.
Right.
And not as accommodating as that we would like to be in our downtown area. You know, we want to make sure that people who have visual impairments are able to make their way around downtown without obstructions.
So. Sure. I think maybe everybody, when it comes up, when the question arises, everybody should spend a day in a wheelchair.
Oh, yeah.
And make them go around town and see what it's like. Because it, and then all of a sudden they'll realize, oh, these people don't have access here, and, you know, they can't go in this place, they can't enjoy this environment, whatever. So.
Right. And it really excludes a large portion. I mean, we know that 1 in 5 people report having a disability. We also know that as you get older, the chances of you having a disability increases substantially. And so what we know is that the whole population is getting older.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we have to start looking at accessibility because there's a huge group of people that are going to need that in the coming years. In fact, the statistic is that in 2030, 1 in 3 people will be over the age of 50.
Well, I'm certainly glad that doesn't apply to me.
Oh, no, me neither.
I'm thinking about schools. You know, educating people certainly starts the younger the better.
Mm-hmm.
And we know that, I think from my own experience with someone with rather serious handicap, that school children, young children, are pretty accepting to everybody. But then as they become a little bit older, you know, they go one way and the person that's in the wheelchair is kind of left staying where they are. Do you do any education in schools, or is that even in your venue at all? I mean, it seems like you have enough to focus on, but
we do a little bit. Actually, I'm glad you asked that because we do. This has just been March's Disability Awareness Month, and we do an essay contest. And we didn't do the essay contest this year, but in the past years, we've done an essay contest with elementary schools to have them write an essay about accessibility. And then this year we did a drawing contest instead of the essay contest. So we go into the schools and, you know, do a little bit of education with them about disability awareness and kind of help them and teachers to come up with lesson plans to help students. This community, again, is wonderful and very, very supportive of that, and is always, always participating. And I think the big thing that we try to do, or that schools try to do, is to include kids with disabilities in everything and not have kids go to a special school. There's still places where there are special schools that kids do go away, but in this community, that's not the case. So people are learning alongside kids with disabilities here, which is so important.
Now, you said that you you cover how many counties?
Seven.
Seven counties. Now, not all the counties are going to be as agreeable, accepting, open to accommodation as Bloomington. What do you run into in some of the other counties?
I don't know that we run into a huge amount of resistance. I just don't think we have as much awareness or as much acceptance and involvement. And again, in one community that we work in, there is a separate school. So that, you know, kind of says something about what we think about people with disabilities if they're not part of the regular education, part of classes, go to high school with other kids. They have to go to the same school from the time they're, you know, in school to the time they graduate at sometimes 21.
I think what we're touching on here is kind of the terminology I heard banting about in the 80s or 90s is mainstreaming, mm-hmm. that all the kids can go to a public school. And do you ever see an exception to that? Because I've mm-hmm. seen maybe an instance here or there where mainstreaming a child was perhaps very complex for everyone involved.
Yeah, I think, well, there's definitely complexities, especially somebody who needs total care, who has pretty significant physical disabilities. So any amount that you can do during the day, I think, is important. Again, it's just important not to put that child in a place where they never have an opportunity to be part of their, you know, a regular school life, or where the kids don't get a chance to really learn about that student. And most of the time I've seen schools where there's maybe a special classroom within the school, but the kids go, you know, they go to lunch, they go to recess, and they do all of those things with the other kids, even if they need more support.
What about in a situation where they might need a caregiver? Because clearly public school teachers, you know, can't be expected to be like right. a caregiver and then teach other children as well.
You know, there are students that get aides that assist mm-hmm. them throughout the day. I'm not as well versed in how that happens and mm-hmm. when that doesn't happen. But I do know of schools. I worked when I was at the university, I worked with some school systems, and I knew that in some cases they were able to get funding for an aide and have that person be with the individual throughout the school day. But it's not a teaching assistant, it's not a teacher.
Right. Well, we have to take another station break. I'm Helen Harrell. You're listening to Interchange, and Susan Renee from Options for a Better Living.
Support for WFHB comes from X Printwear and Promotions, specializing in corporate apparel, athletic wear, promotional products, business cards, and letterhead. X Printwear is located on Bloomington's west side. More information is available online at xprintwear.com.
To Interchange. Thanks for staying with us tonight. I'm Helen Harrell, and I'm talking with Susan Renee, who is the Executive Director of Options for Better Living. And we've been talking about all different aspects of disabilities and assisting people. And one of the things that comes to mind for me when we've been talking about the extremes of physical and mental challenges for people, I think we have kind of a new category now that our generation is facing, all the veterans coming back with various injuries.
Yes.
From physical to mental. Certainly. Are you adjusting programming to meet their needs? Have you had an encounter with any of these veterans coming back that have come for services?
Well, we've had the good fortune to be connected to a program that was just developing. It's called the Crane Learning and Employment Center. Mm-hmm. And it's actually focusing energy on veterans with disabilities, and specifically veterans who've have a disability as a result of conflict, and are seeing many more young men and women coming out with physical disabilities, emotional disabilities, and having difficulty, those men and women having difficulty getting reintegrated into the work world. So this program actually provides assistance so that the veteran can go back to school and can prepare for a job, and actually provide them with some opportunities for employment. Initially, they started working, we started working at the Crane, at Crane, and they employed a number of individuals. I think they're up to almost 50 individuals that they've employed there. And they started out with the idea that they were just going to focus on veterans from Iraq and Afghanistan who suffered a disability, and found, as a result of the outreach that they did, that there were so many veterans out there with disabilities from the Gulf War, from the Vietnam War, that weren't working and that wanted to go back to work, and that needed some help to do that. So they've expanded to start to work with veterans regardless who have a disability. And it's been fascinating because we're seeing, of course, a lot of veterans with PTSD. Mm-hmm. We're seeing a lot of head injuries that have resulted in some learning disabilities for individuals, and more of that, honestly, than, you know, amputations or those kinds of physical disabilities. I think that's made it more challenging.
Well, I think the mental PTSD certainly is something that's very difficult to deal with, and that those of us that lived through the Vietnam era and probably lost family and friends in that war, know that a great many of the homeless are because of untreated veterans who just did not receive any help. And, you know, I'm not sure why our government and the military fell down in that era, because a lot of people, they used to call it shell shock from World War II, and they offered support for the soldiers back then. And then it seemed like the Vietnam era, they just kind of ignored that was a reality for a number of years. And so who is funding this? Is the military funding this whole program now for the veterans, or you still have to?
Actually, this program is being funded by the state through a grant from Workforce Development and Lilly. And Lilly actually stepped up and has funded it 2 years in a row. And they've been able to expand now as a result of that funding to the Indianapolis area. And I think the goal is to have another 50 individuals up there. And what they've done is looked at, there's all this employment opportunity at local bases like Crane. Mm-hmm. And so they're also working at, I can't recall the name of it, in Indianapolis. They're working at a base in Indianapolis. They're looking at private employment as well. But for a lot of these veterans, there's some stability if they're able to get into government employment. And the other thing that's been fascinating is just the system that, and I think that's part of the issues that veterans have had up to this point in time, is, you know, going from being active military to going into the veterans program can take a long time.
Yes.
And by the time you get into the veterans program, which has, you know, some of those back to work programs, you know, it may be that, you know, you're just frustrated, and maybe, you know, your disability has been exacerbated and not comfortable going back to work.
Well, I think a lot of the jobs one is trained for in the military don't apply to civilian life when they come back. So, you know, like
that's why the retraining is so important, the education is so important, and we really did that after World War II, you're right, but we didn't necessarily put all that energy into these veterans that are coming back in terms of getting them back into school and, you know, making sure that they knew that, that we were going to be there to support them.
So how do you work with this program? Is it more of a referral connection or?
It is. Actually, we initially were, you know, working together to help them kind of set things up and employed the people that were part of that company and so or part of that program. And so now they've spun off and in the next, I don't know, 3-4 months are going to be their own not-for-profit. So it's kind of we incubated them, I guess, as it were.
Well, you've been involved with this whole era, during an era, certainly, of disability and various levels and degrees. What are some of the things that you see changing now? I mean, it seems to me that treatment kind of correlates with diagnosis, and we're better at terminology and diagnosis of various learning disabilities. Physical disabilities you can usually see, and they're pretty much easy to kind of categorize or attribute to something. But learning disabilities, mental disabilities are a little different. Is there any particular area where things are really kind of growing and expanding and more research? And
well, there's a lot more research now, and we're particularly looking at the area of autism. That we've seen a substantial growth in the number of individuals diagnosed with autism over the last 10 years. It's gone from 1 in 1,000, I'm sorry, to 1 in 100. So there's been this exponential increase in the number of individuals with that diagnosis. Now, what we're trying to figure out is that because we're better at diagnosing? Probably. But it's also, most experts think, something environmental happening to cause that significant of an increase. We know better now, you know, about autism and about how to diagnose for autism, certainly. But again, the sheer numbers are, you know, it's just not explained entirely by improvements in diagnosis.
Well, not all people with autism either really have special needs either.
Right.
It's kind of that scale from the savant who can only really do one thing in life to a person who really functions fairly well.
Right. Yeah, oftentimes when people think of individuals with autism, they think of Rain Man.
Right, exactly.
And then that's their experience. But yeah, individuals with autism have, you know, they call it the autism spectrum. And individuals can have, you know, a mild, I hate to say a mild case of autism. That doesn't sound right. But they can be affected in a more mild way in terms of autism.
Sure.
And they can have a more significant disability that inhibits their abilities in a number of different areas. But, you know, when you say autism, it's not one thing. It is. It's many things.
It's like an umbrella term for lots of degrees of it seems like it's almost psychological, physical, and emotional and learning all kind of, there's something dynamic going on in there that there's a short circuit somewhere.
There is, and there, we're pretty sure it's a neural cause. And we just haven't honed in. People have looked at parts of the brain that are smaller in individuals with that diagnosis. So they think it's connected in some way to that, but there just isn't any, you know, definite here's the cause. And probably we're not going to find a cause, as with a lot of things. We're going to find a number of causes.
Sure.
But the important thing is that we do find that diagnosis early so that kids can get into intervention and at an early point in their lives. And that's, you know, one of the things that I think has had a tremendous impact on our field is early intervention. I mean, really, it's not been around that long. Just in the last 30, 40 years have we had, it's called First Steps in Indiana, where from 0 to 3, it doesn't matter. You aren't tested necessarily. You are assumed if there's some kind of problem in the birth or early on that you're at risk of having a disability. So those kids can get access to services, you know, during that time without a lot of rigmarole.
So this starts being tracked right at birth, like with hospitals and doctors
yes.
and nurses.
Yeah, and autism in itself is generally diagnosed in the toddler years. So, but the earlier the better. You know, I have a granddaughter who has a learning disability, and we were fortunate that we were able to find that out on early on, and she's had services since she was, I think, 6 months old, and it's made a huge difference because she has a speech delay, a fairly significant speech delay, and I think if she hadn't had the speech therapy that she had in First Steps, she wouldn't be able to enter kindergarten, which we expect her to be able to do mm-hmm. Without much problem in the next year.
Well, I think if you look back and think about the knowledge that we've accumulated over the years, there were many people and children that had certain kinds of special needs many, many, many years ago. But everybody thought, well, they're just an odd person, or, well, they just aren't good at this, or that child just has a terrible temper. You know, they just kind of brushed it off. But as we increase our knowledge, now we can address some of these things.
Right.
And it makes your job harder and busier. You have more categories and more people to deal with. With the changing economy, and you're based on funding and grants, where do you go from here? Are you making plans? Are you cutting back? How is it affecting services for people in all these seven counties?
Well, I think, as I said earlier, that we're expecting things to be fairly austere for the next year and a half or so. For most people, the recession started in 2008. For us, it started about a year and a half later. When the impact hit the state mm-hmm. revenues, then they started looking at Medicaid and cutting back Medicaid. So it's been a struggle and will be a struggle, because until the state revenues increase and things go back, hopefully they will. I'm always optimistic. We're going to be dealing with the cuts, I think. So in the near term, I see things, you know, not getting any better, and people not really having access to services. So those waiting lists are probably going to get longer. I'm assuming in the next 2 years, 2 to 3 years, that we'll see things go back and things open up a little bit more in terms of services. It's going to have to. I believe that one of the things that's going to make a huge impact is the baby boom generation that gets to the point where they need more services, which we know the first of them are starting to mm-hmm. retire now. And I think they're going to be more demanding about the types of services and supports that are available to help them be part of their community. And I see that as having a huge impact on environments that are going to be more accessible, and communities are going to be more open to making things accessible because they're going to have to. So I do think that's going to have a nice spillover effect on individuals with disabilities of all ages.
Perhaps it's because of my age, but one of the things that I've been thinking about is senior employment. Clearly, when people retire, our generation seems to be, we don't want to just quit. We don't want to just sit at home in the rocking chair. And I think seniors have a lot to offer. But there doesn't seem to be correspondingly a lot of employment for seniors or retired people in this community. And I'm wondering, that's one of the things you're talking about in our generation, is what options, what goals you can focus on to improve that situation so that, like people like me, when we retire, we can maybe find a part-time job.
Right. Well, I can tell you
or
right
a way
now
to get back.
We would love to have, and we do have, people who are retired who have come to work for us. We have a gentleman right now who worked for the state and retired and came to work and works for us part-time. It's a very rewarding thing for people to do. You get to connect with an individual. You get to be out and about in the community oftentimes and meet somebody you might not otherwise have a chance to meet. And really get to know their community. That's the other thing that I think is a side benefit of working for Options, is that because what you're doing is helping people to connect, you get to know the community better.
Well, there might be some room for some seniors to volunteer with Options, for
there
instance.
There are. They're very
to
much.
Help out with some of the people that may need some assistance. That would
No, definitely, definitely. I say both paid and volunteer opportunities. Again, we'd love to talk to people if they're interested in doing something with us. We have information meetings that we hold a couple times a week. So if somebody's just interested in learning more about the organization, they can come in and they can sit in on those just to see what we do.
What are some of your goals for the organization? For the future.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the main goals that we have is to really make an impact on the housing that's available for people with disabilities in our communities. Especially in this community, one of the big problems is affordable, accessible housing. You know, everything's built not with the individuals with disabilities in mind, but with students in mind. So if we can, that's in the next 2-3 years, what we hope to do is have a few projects where we develop some housing that is, again, more accessible but also affordable for the individuals that we serve. Because a lot of people that we serve are, you know, reliant on public assistance for their, you know, to cover their housing costs.
Mm-hmm.
Someone on public assistance has to spend 113% of their income on housing. Yeah, if you do the math, you know that's impossible to do. So
Right, that's a lot. That's unreasonable, totally unreasonable.
Right. So we need to do more of that. So that's one of our major goals. And then the other is to really expand the employment opportunities for individuals in the counties outside of Monroe. We've done a good job in Monroe, but we really want to work hard again in Lawrence, Owen, and Brown, and Morgan counties. And do a better job of connecting with employers and building some employer networks there.
I would think transportation would be an issue, too, especially in the rural communities.
Transportation is, we call it the T word because it's it really is the rub, because how do you get connected in community if you can't drive? We work really closely with Rural Transit and Bloomington Transit. We're fortunate that we have those. We'd love to see that expand and be more available in on, you know, evenings, weekends, when people with disabilities can't get out and about.
Well, quickly before we wrap up here, can you want to tell people how to get in touch with you and options, and if they need services or want to refer someone? Or
love to if you want to get in contact with us, our 800 number is 800-875-9615, and then our website is optionsfbl.com. it's options, F as in Frank, B as in boy, L as in Lloyd.com.
Well, Susan, thank you so much for joining me tonight. I think we've learned a lot about what we are doing to help people and what we still need to do. So, and let's hope government funding continues to support your efforts, certainly. This has been Helen Harrell on Interchange at WFHB. And I want to thank our assistant producer, Shane Young, for engineering tonight's program. Interchange is produced by William Morris, and our executive producer is January Jones. The original theme music by Jamil Effiam. Now stay tuned for Stardust with Tillman coming up next on WFHB.
Real people.
Real issues.
This is your forum.
This is Interchange.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers working in the studios of Community Radio WFHB in Bloomington, Indiana.
Interchange fosters unfiltered open dialogue on the people, issues, and events impacting life in South Central Indiana and beyond.
Comments, suggestions, and program ideas may be sent directly to the Interchange staff.
The email address is news@wfhb.org.
That address once again is news@wfhb.org.